Jason Waller here, True Underdog Podcast and YouTube channel. Listen, make sure you subscribe today. You can go to iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can go to our YouTube channel, True Underdog, or you can visit trueunderdog.com and subscribe to all of it.
Damn, 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 True Underdog. Damn, damn, unleash damn, the power within.
Hey, underdogs, it's Jason Waller, host of the True Underdog Podcast, and I'm back with another True Underdog Classic. This series features some of my favorite conversations from the True Underdog's earliest days. Today, we're throwing it back to my interview with Jordan Harbinger, host of the Jordan Harbinger Show and former host of the Art of Charm Podcast. Jordan Harbinger Show was awarded Apple's best and most downloaded new show in 2018. It's consistently named top Apple and Spotify podcast. Bam! Jordan is the real deal, and he is fun to interview, and he is an icon in the podcast game. During this interview, Jordan and I talked about how to reinvest in your business and incentivize your employees to earn their spot at your company. We also talked about what it's like to host a podcast and how toxic social media can actually be. You don't want to miss today's episode of the True Underdog Classic, Jordan Harbinger. Make decisions quickly. Jordan, how you doing?
Good. I'm glad to be here on the Guy Fieri Show.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of people say that. I think that I pull it off a little hotter than he does, but don't tell him I said that. So I do want to, you know, I'm glad to have you on the show. You're in California. How's the weather?
Yeah, it's hot as hell. But I mean, at least before, like last week, it was like raining ashes from the sky. So I'll take hot over raining ashes from the sky.
Are the skies still crazy looking? Like just flames?
No.
Still? Oh, that's
No, not where I am in NorCal. It's actually pretty nice outside right now.
I love NorCal. Okay, yeah. Well, good. Listen, if you can just kind of introduce yourself. I know you've had a couple shows, one of them the Art of Charm podcast. And I know you've been doing this a hot minute, but kind of talk about what you've been doing and why your podcast is so successful.
Yeah, so I do the Jordan Harbinger Show now. And actually, it's funny. I was with this other company for a while, and it just... You've probably worked with business partners in the past where you're just thinking like, why aren't things working? And then you get off on your own and you're like, oh, I got it. Cause you guys are knuckleheads,
right,
you know,
right.
And you're dead weight and I don't need you. And so that's kind of where it's been for me for the last couple of years is I'm like, oh my gosh, like double in size again, as you and I were sort of talking about before the show. And I realized, oh, okay. It really is funny that sometimes the whole is not greater than the sum of its parts, as it were, in business. So I've been podcasting since 2006. Before that, I was a Wall Street attorney. And I started podcasting originally because I was giving talks and I was like, you know, if I record these talks, then I don't have to repeat myself. But there was no place to put a sound file on the internet for other people to go and download.
You were podcasting before it was cool and hip, dude, really, like one of the OGs.
Yeah. Like a decade before it was even cool and hip. I mean,
that's awesome.
At least... Yeah, like podcasting got cool / hip in what, 2014, 2015 maybe. I had 8, 9, 10 years going before that where it was like, whatever, nerd, you know, that's where I was at.
You like been there, done that. Got it. You
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Been there, done that / it wasn't even like, I'm going to make money doing this. It was, I work on Wall Street. I don't need to make myself a crappy internet job. Why would I do that? You know, I'm a finance attorney. And then it was like, oh, wait a minute. I hate being a finance attorney and I like this hobby that I'm doing, but there's no way I'm ever going to make that much money doing this. And then it was like selling coaching, selling courses. It's like, oh, it's a good lead gen source. And now I'm like, oh, actually what's going on here is I can make a bunch of money because ads are a thing, but there weren't digital ads in podcasting before. So being able to capitalize on things like that is relatively new.
No, look, that's what's the phenomenon here is people don't understand. I mean, I run a solar company right now and I'm doing this on the side and it's starting to take ground. We've got, you know, a few hundred thousand subscribers and I've got 40 million views on YouTube. I love this. I don't get paid to do this. I'm paying to do this. But I'm where you were many years ago. And it's like, look, the future down the road, 7, 10 years when I'm out of the solar business, I would love to do this and have that opportunity to get paid to do it, to share success stories and how to overcome adversity and how to open a business. And you're right. A lot of people listen to your show and shows like yours to get better. There are tools in order to make their life better. And people need that. And then these advertisers, whether it's Coke, whether it's water, whether it's Pepsi, whatever it is, they'll pay to stick their ad on there. Is that how that works?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. So like I'll have a campaign from Microsoft Teams come on, you know, which is like a Slack competitor. And they'll say like, all right, we want, you know, $100,000 worth of advertising in November. And then you just put the commercials in and I record like, hey, Microsoft Teams, go check it out. You know, just go to MicrosoftTeams.com/Jordan, something like that. And that's easy. And people come to expect that. And you can make the ads funny. You don't have to drone on. You can make it interesting. And then what's good about this is with podcasting, people sort of realize like, okay, this is a production that costs a lot to make. There's a lot of time involved. I like this creator. I'm going to do it. So you don't get the same kind of complaints as you do when you're watching, you know, a cooking show and there's 15 commercials in a row, or when you're listening to the radio and commercials come on and you're just angry about it. With right. podcasting, a lot of times people are like, yeah, you know, okay, I want to support this show, so I'm going to go buy this mattress and use this coupon code. Unless you overdo it with the ads, people are pretty cool with it.
You know, you started doing this and still doing Wall Street and then let it go, or how did that transition happen?
Yeah, I started this show while I was in law school and then kept it going while I was working. And then I was moonlighting for a period of time on Sirius XM satellite radio when my show got picked up. And my law firm was like, well, as long as you don't fall behind on your work. And then the 08 crash, well, it was 07, but that basically that whole thing started and we ran out of work. And I was like, I'm just going to do this hobby that I've been doing. And then they let all of us go with like almost a year long severance package. So I was like, great, I'm just going to use that to get my business off the ground. And I remember thinking at the time, you'll like this because you run a business. At the time, I remember going, 9 months of severance? Oh, I'm not going to need that long to get this business off the ground. And then it was like 3 years later, I was like, when do we start making money? This is so hard.
People forget and think that just because you own a business, you get paid. And one of the tips I always try to tell people, you know, I've opened and created three successful businesses. And this, by far, I've been blessed to be the biggest. But rule number one for me is you got to reinvest in your company. You pay yourself last. People forget that. And the companies that fall are the ones that try to pay themselves first or too much. And they forget that you're reinvesting in your company long-term. It's not about the paycheck today.
Yeah, you see those guys on Shark Tank and like Mark Cuban will go, okay, well, how much do you need to survive? And the guy will go, I'm fine with six figures. And he's like, I'm out. Like, I'm fine with six. I bet you're fine with six figures, buddy. What do you think I was going to do? Cut you a seven-figure check for getting an investment deal from me? I'm fine with six figures. How about you're going to make $24,000 a year until this thing is profitable? How's that sound? You're going to be sleeping in the back on the office on a freaking futon and eating whatever we cater for the employees and working 6 days a week. I'm fine with six figures. This guy.
That's the world we live in, though. I mean, even hiring people, you're like, people like, do I get a car package? Do I get a cell phone? Do I get a laptop? It's like, I mean, you like to grind. We have sales reps making $250,000 a year, field energy consultants that do well, but we'll have professionals show up and they're like, am I not getting all these things? And ours is a commission only employee position. But when we have 300 reps and 30 of them are making $250,000 a year, that's a big deal. You got to sell the dream, but too many people think everything should be given to them without earning it. And I think sales really is the first step to entrepreneurship, to open a business. You got to be able to sell yourself and be able to live very frugal, like you said.
Definitely. I won't mention this company, but I've got some friends that run a company and I'm trying not to like, I don't want anybody to be able to guess who this is. But one of the things they were complaining about recently was they have these kind of, pardon the stereotype, but like fat old sales guys who are like, you know, it's not negative because they're fat and old, but the problem is they're like fat old lazy sales guys and they fly everywhere first class. And which, not there's anything wrong with that, but when you're flying to a meeting in Dubai, I get it. When you're flying to Albuquerque for the day, just who cares if you're flying? Why do you need a ticket that's $900 for a 2-hour flight? You know, just take the damn thing. And then, like you said, car package, they want a laptop. Fine. A laptop and a cell phone is nothing. But why do you need me to rent your car? Just get a higher commission or spend some of your own. It just doesn't make any money. And they're just like chasing perks. And they're like, well, you know, we're getting offers to go to XYZ Co. over there. And they offer this and that and the other thing. And it's like, do you want to make money or do you want a leather interior? What are you doing? And they're just kind of like, And you know what's ironic? Those guys, they never close any deals. It's always the young guys who are making like one fifth of the amount of commission that those guys are on because of their seniority schedules and everything. And they're making all the sales and these old guys are going to meetings. That's it. They're just going to meetings all day, every day and like taking severance packages when they don't perform.
You know, two things. One, you said you had partners and you're doing that. And you felt handcuffed. Been there before. Know exactly what that's like where you're like, I feel like I'm in a cage and I can't take this to the next level because this dude wants to go too slow, right? I completely understand that. You got to break it and you got to move on. Secondly, you know, one of the rules I try to emphasize to people, and I think you can appreciate this, especially with some of the people I want to talk about that you've brought on your show, but I have an 80-20 rule, right? 80% of the staff keep their job every month, 20% we fire, and we draw the KPI line. So I'm a big believer of 20% of your team is doing 80% of the work. The next 60% is doing 20%. That bottom 20%, you need to keep cutting and burning. If you want to grow a company like this, you have to do that. They have to have KPIs. They're not hitting it because people get stagnant. They have a shelf life. They start to turn rotten like milk. You got to throw them out. You can't keep, like you just said, you get the fat and old lazy guys. They feel comfortable. It needs to be uncomfortable. And those that are hungry, especially in sales, you got to keep pushing the bar up. And the way to do that is replace that bottom 20%. That's what I've seen growing businesses. And we try to do in every department, even installs, customer service. We hold them accountable because too many times as an organization or as an entrepreneur, as a business, you're paying for people that it's just a job and they're doing just enough. And my argument is we pay someone 100% their paycheck. We should get 100% effort. You agree?
Yeah. I mean, dude, there are employees that treat it like a job. You're in real trouble when you have a partner and equity holder that also thinks, hey, I was working with guys that they didn't say this explicitly, but the whole vibe from them was, when are you guys going to make a big move so that we all can cash out? And I remember them saying some variation of this, like, hey, when are we going to be able to cash in on this? When are we going to be able to cash in on that? And I go, didn't you spend all day watching football yesterday? You know what I was doing? I was making sales calls. And they're like, oh, well, did you have a lot of work backed up? And I go, yeah, because I work 7 days a week and I have a lot of work all the time. Why? I don't care if you watch football, go ahead, but why are you asking me when I'm going to sell more? The answer is, what the hell are you doing all day? Besides what, like, who are you? And why do you think that you're worth the same amount? And I remember we were doing distributions and our finance guy was like, and this isn't a partner, it's just like a financial person. And they were like, oh, I noticed that Jordan is making this much and other people are doing that. And my business partners got super angry. And our CFO was like, well, Jordan makes 100% of the sales. And they were like, yeah, but we're all partners here. And the financial guy goes, like, we got in this big thing. I opted out. I just went to go get something to eat because I didn't want to be a part of this discussion. Because I was like, if you make the wrong choice, I'm leaving. But the CFO and our accountant were like, you can't get rid of the guy making 100% of the sales. If he wants you guys to all get paid the same, that's fine, but you're going to be underpaying him to do what he's doing and he's going to be disincentivized. So they finally came to the agreement that I should be making what I was making, but I was making like 3 or 4 times more than the other partners were in the business. And it actually caused a huge rift because there were guys that were like, why don't we make as much? Cause we have a so-called equivalent title or the same amount of equity. And then there were people who knew how to run a business and they were like, you're going to screw up this entire thing if you don't incentivize your salespeople. And it was bizarre to me because it was so obvious that even the people under me in sales, we had to incentivize. And they were like, well, he can't make more than me. And I'm like, why? Because you think you're entitled to it because you own a third of the business. Why would the sales guy not make more than you? So we ran into all these like ego problems where guys who just thought they should be making a lot of money because they were 30 and wanted more money. And that eventually ended up sinking pretty much the whole business. I ended up obviously leaving and starting the Jordan Harbinger show, but I even see the problem now. What's funny is the way that they solved this problem, looking at their structure now, is they hired a bunch of like 22-year-old kids who don't ask for any money, barely. And now those are the people running everything. And obviously the business is totally screwed. But it's amazing what an ego can do. When they put me on commission only, I said, okay. And I made like $800 a month for like a year. And then I started making like $35,000 a month for like 4 years. And that pissed everyone off. And I remember talking with my CFO and going, why weren't they mad when I was making $800 a year? Shouldn't they have been mad that we weren't all equal like they're mad about right now? And looking at it now, I'm like, anybody that comes into my company that has like an ego issue, I kick their ass out the door so freaking fast. And people be like, what did he do? And I'm like, nothing. But it's only a matter of time till they sabotage this other person's deal. They sink a project because they don't want someone else to succeed and get credit while they're sitting on the sidelines with their thumb in their ass. You know, they got to look good. And that doesn't mean that they're going to work hard to look good. They might do that. They may do that. But they will also tear someone else's ass down so that they look good. And we can't have that in the organization.
Now, let's hear from our sponsors.
So, one of the things I want to talk to you about on your show, I mean, you've had some big guests on your show, and your show's been booming for a hot minute. I saw you had the late Kobe Bryant on your show. You've had Tony Hawk on your show. Who was the most intriguing guest that you've had on your show?
Oh, man, that's tough. I've had some pretty interesting folks on the show. I mean, some of these, like, former terrorists that turn into informants for the United States or Israel, those guys are pretty interesting. Some of the guys like that get there's a guy that got kidnapped by Al Qaeda in Syria, journalist, and he escaped. That was pretty interesting. There was a kid that escaped from North Korea. That was pretty interesting. I mean, it's hard to find like a number one most insightful guest. Ray Dalio, the investor, he's interesting and insightful. So it's tough because you have all these people that are insightful in their own way, from Howie Mandel to Mark Cuban to somebody who just didn't start any business, but, you know, escaped like essentially a concentration camp in North Korea or escaped being held by ISIS. Like, these are fascinating stories from people, and it kind of leaves you going, huh, I guess me, you know, losing that deal was not such a big deal after all. Or like, I guess that flat tire this morning wasn't the end of the world compared to this guy who's has this problem. Or also just watching people build really great things can be really awe-inspiring. You know, you can find somebody like, yeah, like Ray Dalio, or even a general who's just done a whole lot of crazy things, made a whole lot of important decisions that could have people's lives in the balance and have like heavy weights on their shoulders. And you just think like, wow. You know, there's people out there that have real burdens, and I'm not one of them. So I guess I can count my blessings, you know?
Yeah, your show's very inspiring. The guests that you've had, some of the content that comes out is pretty awesome. I mean, a lot of people don't get to talk about the stuff you get to talk about with those kind of guests. But you mentioned about somebody being kidnapped by Al-Qaeda. So you grew up with anxiety as a kid. I've got two of my kids. I have four kids that have major social anxiety. So I want to talk about that. And then also, you've been kidnapped twice.
Yeah. So we can start wherever you want. I mean, social anxiety is probably a good place to start, because I think even now, and especially back then, people thought if you had anxiety, you were just being weird. And I was just considered shy. Nobody was like, oh, what a weirdo. They were just like, oh, Jordan's quiet, you know, whatever. And some of the girls would be like, why are you so shy? Emily likes you. And it would just make it worse, you know, but I mean, that's middle school. But a lot of my buddies were like, why are you so shy? Like, Lauren wants to go out with you. She talks about you all the time. Why don't you do it? And that would make it worse. And my friends were like, what's this guy's problem? And as I got older, I started to get over it and get through it. But it actually took quite a bit of work, and it was really tough. And you try and mask it, but until you work on the underlying issues, you're not really going to get through it. And that's really been sort of key. And I think a lot of kids probably have it now, because they're looking at, so I can imagine social media makes it worse. You know, you're looking at like Instagram, and it's like, why does John have more followers than me? Look at the vacation that they're on. Like, the FOMO that we have as adults is obviously magnified times 1,000 for kids, because as adults, we're generally less consumed with social status than kids are. Kids only have social status. You know, I can just go, man, I'm sick of not feeling like I have as much as other people. I'm going to whatever, turn off my phone. Kids are like, what do you mean? I have to go to school tomorrow. I have to talk with everyone else who has more stuff. And then kids, of course, are like, your shoes are ugly. You're a loser. Just kill yourself. And adults don't generally do that. You know, maybe a couple horrible people do that, but really they don't. You know, it's just something that exists mostly in your head. Kids will rub it in each other's face. So kids have it much worse than adults. And now that we have it on the internet at scale, I can only imagine what like the sort of minor bullying that every kid went through in my middle school. I had kids tell me like, you're a loser, your shoes suck. And then after school, they're like, do you want to come to my birthday party? It's on Friday. We're going roller skating. And you're like, okay. And it's just like kids being crappy to each other. But now if you have a real bully, the kind that makes you want to leave school and avoid them, they can reach you on Saturday afternoon in your house because they're on your phone, you know? So like, there's all kinds of things that kids deal with now that I think are just straight up unhealthy. And my kid's 14 months old, and I talked to my wife, Jen, and I'm like, what are we going to do?
You know, I've had my 13-year-old was bullied a lot, and I've had to bounce her school to school. And she's probably my strongest, meaning like that I've seen, strongest child. But it's just natural bullying about, like, you know, picking on her at anything and everything. She cuts her hair short. Oh, you look like a boy. And we've had to bounce around schools. And you're right. My instinct, I've got, you know, 21, 16, 13, and 10. And I can tell you, 14 months, you're good right now. You got a while. But even my 10-year-old has social media. And he's like, Dad, people are mean to me on my YouTube. I said, well, then delete the comments or let me take it away. No, I need it. You're right. This is what happens. And the kids are so mean. And you just got to inquire to your children. What are you looking at? What's going on? Talk to me. I told my daughter when all this was going on, I said, look, there's nothing you can't tell me that I'll bury the bodies for you. So if you're ever holding anything back, you got to come to me. I've got to be able to help you. And we've had some good conversations. And you're right. It's sad that this is the world we live in, where people look at beautiful people all day long that are photoshopped and they're on vacation and people get depressed. I mean, if I sat there and looked at six packs all day, I look great in the pool from waist up, right? From like right here up, I'm great. But then it's like I eat bad. You can tell if I did that all day, I'd be depressed. And most women and a lot of kids, they're looking at that and comparing themselves. And it's unfortunate. It puts them in a bad spot, I think.
It does. You know, it's funny that you should mention your son says they're mean on YouTube. That never changes. YouTube is the worst platform for people being mean. And I don't know what it is, but something about YouTube makes it too easy for people to comment. I understand that a lot of the social media that younger people use is unfortunately the stuff where people are the worst.
I agree 100%. And you said it right on. And all of those platforms are pretty rough. You were kidnapped twice. I want to hear that story.
Yeah. So I'll keep them short because, you know, they're like told all over the place and not super relevant. But one time I was in Mexico. I mean, I used to live in Mexico City, which is funny because I'll say something about Mexico and people are like, you need to get out and travel more. And I'm like, cool. Not only did I live in Mexico, I got kidnapped in Mexico. Tell me more about your trip to the beach. 20 years old at the time. I'm 40 now. So this is like the year 2000, which used to sound like the future. So I was living there. I lived in kind of the hood because I was 20 and had no money. I worked for this nonprofit, which also didn't pay. So I lived in the middle of nowhere. I got into a fake taxi. And in the fake taxi, we kept driving around. And funnily enough, related to our social media conversation, there were no mobile phones really back then. You just didn't have one. I mean, I think I used, did I buy a cheap Nokia? If I had one, there were no apps.
Yeah, we're the same. There was bag phones for cars back then. We're about the same.
Yeah. And like Europe, you could get like a Nokia that had a black and white screen and had this game called Snake, which is still awesome. But like you didn't have like Instagram and social media on your phone. You didn't have data on your phone. So I wasn't looking at my phone because there was nothing to look at. I don't even think I had a phone in Mexico. And if I did, I can't remember. And the driver was like driving in the wrong direction. And I noticed that because I wasn't looking at my phone. Now I think 2020 hindsight, I would never have even noticed. I would have just gotten kidnapped. I'm like, why are we in Colombia now? Like, why did we drive this far? But I just kept driving, or he kept driving. We drove into the hood and I was like, oh my God, where are we going? And he's like, I just need directions. And I was suspicious because I'd asked to go to the center of town. And it's like, if you were in DC and you tell a cabby, I want to go to the White House, and they're like, I need directions, you immediately are like, wait, what? You know, everybody knows where that is. If I'm in New York and I want to go to Times Square, the cabby doesn't have to ask directions. So I thought, that's suspicious. So he stopped. It wouldn't let me out of the car, wouldn't let me go, wouldn't drive me back. And I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm getting kidnapped right now. So when he finally did stop, I choked his ass out, man. You know, he tried to get out of the cab and I stopped him from getting out of the cab, and he tried to reach for the glove box where I assume he had a knife or a gun or something. And I guess it's not really a rear naked choke when there's a car seat between you and the other guy, but it was a sort of rear naked choke sleeper, if you will. And yeah, he was 50 years old, something, and sat in a cab all day eating freaking tostadas. And I was 20, going to the gym twice a day, eating carne asada burritos to get enough protein to build up. You know, I was 209 pounds. Right now, I'm 168. So imagine 30 pounds more, but less body fat, same height. I mean, I was an absolute tank. So this guy just didn't stand a chance. And, you know, I was doing like, we didn't call it mixed martial arts at the time. We just said jujitsu and boxing. It was literally just some boxing and jujitsu. So this guy, I mean, I am not tough at all, but this guy was well outmatched. The problem is I couldn't get out of the car. So after I choked him out, I'm like, great, I'm stuck in this damn car in the middle of the hood. I had to crawl between the two seats, which is not easy, but it wouldn't be easy for me now, let alone 209 pounds, you know, 30 pounds more than I am now. So I crawl between the two seats. It's a Volkswagen Beetle, so it's not even a big car. Open his door, push him out, try to drive the car, can't drive a car, stick shift, but a stick shift from 1968. I mean, even if I could drive a stick, which I couldn't because I was vibrating with anxiety, I wouldn't been able to drive a car that had 30 years of clutch residue and, you know, rust and whatever in there. So then I took the keys out because I didn't want him to wake up in a few seconds and then just drive after me. And then I chucked the keys and just ran. And, you know, what's interesting is I expected him to come after me at some point, and I thought maybe he couldn't find the keys. But now I'm like, I finally got into another car. Somebody finally picked me up because they were like, why is this white guy in the middle of this hood? I was near a main road. And he said, what are you doing? And I was like, I got kidnapped and I'll ride in the trunk. Just get me out of here. Because he didn't want me to get in the car because I was like sweating, you know? But I was like wearing like Banana Republic chinos in the middle of like a corrugated metal neighborhood, you know?
Probably nervous too. I mean, you're sweating, you're white.
Yeah,
I
looked like I was on straight up meth, you know? Like, what is this guy doing? But I was so out of place. And I also had bleach blonde hair at the time, like you. So, I mean, I was clearly not from the neighborhood, right? And I was like waving frantically, and like guys on motorcycles were like, what the f-? You know? So finally this guy stops and he's like, what are you doing here? And he speaks a little bit of English. I spoke Spanish, but I was like, I don't know how to say kidnapped in Spanish. So I was like, I've kidnapped, help, whatever. And then I was like, man, I'll ride in the trunk. Just get me the frick out of here. So he's like, okay, fine. He didn't make me ride the trunk, but he drives me somewhere and he's like, where do you want to go? I'm like, the police. And he's like, let me explain something to you. I'm not taking you to the police because I don't want any part of this. And also, I would not go to the cops if I were you, because you basically just said that you choked out a cab driver. Do you know if he's okay? And I was like, no, I don't. I don't know if he's okay. And they're like, yeah, so maybe you like murdered a cabbie, and maybe the cops are in on whatever kidnapping operation that involves kidnapping Americans. Either they were going to chop you into little pieces or they were going to steal your money. But do you really want to find out which one it is when the cops bring you back here in handcuffs? And I was like, good point. So he's like, I would just get out of this town like now. So I went home to the family where I lived, packed all my stuff, told them I was leaving. They were like, donde? Right? Like, what are you talking about? And then I was like, yep, peace. And I just moved. I moved like the next day.
Now, a word from our sponsors.
That's pretty scary. I couldn't imagine. Yeah. I remember having bleached hair at 20, and then I went many years without it. And 2 years ago, I bleached it again. So yeah,
nice.
It came back, by the way. So if you're interested, I know somebody.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe I'll try it again. I do like my dark locks right now, but it was scary.
We could have the third version of Guy Ferrari. It's okay.
Guy Fieri. Yeah. Or just call it Guy. I think Guy Ferrari is the porn star version of Guy Fieri. It sounds like it. I bet if we Google it, that's a real thing.
That's great. All right. So tell me about the second time you got kidnapped.
So the second time was a little bit more serious, much longer story, but I'll keep it shorter than the last one. I lived in a country called Serbia, which is part of the former Yugoslavia, not Siberia. Everyone's like, oh, isn't it cold? And I'm like, no, Serbia, next to Croatia. And so I went there and I love that place. Great place. A lot of cool people there, really good friends that I'm still in touch with. But I was working for the Department of Defense. And so everybody who was there was like, oh, you're a spy, you're a spy, you're a spy, you're a spy. Well, that sort of traveled around until their internal security services were like, oh, he must be a spy. And they would like harass us and like bug us and, you know, do annoying stuff, make me like sign documents and like go register and check in with them all the time. Just stupid stuff like that. And so I got really sick of that. And like every time I would go, it would be a little bit more of an annoying process, a little bit more of a tedious process, a little bit more of like a longer process. And then one day they were just like, you have to wait in here. And I was like, I'm not going to wait in a cell. And they're like, well, you have to, you're at the police station at night. You must've done something wrong. And I was like, no, the dumbass before you told me to wait. And now the shift change guy assumes that I'm there because I was supposed to be getting arrested, throws me in a cell overnight with a bunch of like hookers who are smoking all night and like yelling. And I'm like, this is bullshit. So I decided I'm not going to come and register anymore, because every time you leave the country, you had to come and register with the police. And I was like, these guys are dumb asses. I'm not doing this anymore. So then they put me on a list of people that was like missing inside the country because I wasn't registered anymore. And they were just looking for me. And one day they found me, and they were the internal security police. But these are like guys that they don't send their finest to go look for missing foreigners. They send their like methed up, druggy idiot, you know, guys on the dole. So they sent these two dumbasses to come and get me and my friend. They're beating up my friend. They were like burning me with cigarettes and stuff. Finally, I just tricked them into letting me escape, because these guys were probably two of the dumbest idiots that you've ever seen on any police force. They were untrained morons. And you have that a lot in countries like that, because they had a civil war there. And so the losing side of the civil war in Bosnia was everybody, but the Serbian side eventually sort of got pushed out. So a lot of Serbs who were there, but in the militia, they now lived in Serbia, but they were quote unquote police officers, because if they were regular civilians, they get prosecuted by the war crimes tribunal. It's like kind of a complicated situation. So they just give these guys badges and then they're above the law. But like, what are you going to do when you have a pig farmer with no pig farm who's used to drinking homemade bootlegger liquor all day, and now his job is to drive around a state-sponsored Jeep and like harass foreigners? And they're usually going after like illegal Albanian immigrants, not Americans. So they were like really keen on finding me. So that was the second time. And it was rough. I had to go to the U.S. Embassy. I got a letter of apology from the foreign minister. Then they had to make up this whole story about how I was like an unregistered foreign agent. So they printed that in the news after they printed the original story. And then they printed a retraction that said, oh, the guy made the whole thing up. It never happened. And I'm like, cool. I've got some burns on me that say otherwise. And there were like tons of witnesses that saw these guys like take us. But it was just like this embarrassing clusterfuck for the Serbian government. And the U.S. government was like, dude, just let it go. You're alive. It's fine. What are we going to do? This is just how stuff works over here. And what was funny was all my Serbian friends were like, yeah, that happens all the time. Not as much anymore, but during the war, it happened all the time. And I was like, so I got a real taste of living under an authoritarian government, like that has massive overstretch of government power. It was like, wow, you really can't do anything about it. Cops and government officials just have all the power in the world, but also they have no power, because we just found some they were threatening me after this. So my friend goes, I know how to handle this. And he went and found some organized crime connected figures, and they just freaking beat the absolute living shit out of these guys. I hope I can say this on your show. They just beat the absolute living shit out of these guys. And they were like, oh, Jordan's going to throw you guys off a bridge. And they were like, oh my God, no, we didn't mean it. We were just joking around. And I was just like, wow, we can literally kill two cops and they're not going to do shit. And this is after they were like, we're going to kill you. And I was like, isn't it ironic that I have no power, and for like 1200 euros, I hold your life in my hands, huh? Interesting. And I remember saying that to them, and these guys were so scared. And I just thought, these are just two pathetic assholes. I'm not going to do this. But I did have their asses kicked into oblivion.
Good, good. That's
great. Yeah, they deserved it.
That's a crazy story. I mean, huh. So back to your podcast. I mean, you know, The Art of Charm, that was the first podcast you're doing. Now you got the Jordan Harbinger Show.
Yeah.
What was The Art of Charm like? That podcast did really well. I think you had it on the air for what, 10 years?
Yeah. Yeah, I had that on the air for 11 years. I actually don't talk about it much because it is absolute not worth your time now. I got to be a little careful because we litigated it. And I'm like, okay, I'll non-disparage, but let me just say, you're not missing anything. The Jordan Harbinger Show, I took the whole audience from the Art of Charm podcast, brought it to the Jordan Harbinger Show. All the guests are on the Jordan Harbinger Show. All the advertisers moved to the Jordan Harbinger Show. But yeah, I built up both podcasts over a long period of time. What's funny is the Jordan Harbinger Show, despite being in existence for about 3 years as of recording right now, is at least 3 to 5 times the size of my old show, because that goes back to our previous conversation about when you are working with absolute deadweight kind of nobodies, you are more you think you're just being left alone to do your own thing. You don't realize how much other people are weighing you down until you slough the weight off, if that makes sense. So you might think like, oh, I'm just going to ignore my boss or my business partner. They don't know what they're doing. I'm just going to stay in my lane. you're actually way more shackled than you think you are. So I recommend to anybody who feels like they're getting weighed down but thinks it's minor to not treat it like that, because there's a really good chance that you are actually operating at about 10, 20% of your potential and you just don't know it.
Nope, that's well said. I mean, I agree. You can't be handcuffed. You can't be held by the short hairs or held hostage. I had an episode that talked about that, from whether it's a relationship or business. If you're held hostage, you're losing. You've got to be able to move that and do what you need to do. So that's very well said. The other thing, so you grew up in Michigan, huh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
right
then
near you.
LA? North Cali.
Yeah, I up and moved to New York. Then I moved to LA from there, got stuck in LA working with, you know, Tweedledum and Tweedledummer for a couple of years. Finally ended up separating from them, moved to NorCal. Actually moved to NorCal before that, realized, gee, I don't miss working in LA at all. And then eventually I was like, I'm out, started the Jordan Harbinger show. And it's funny because every move that I've made, I'm like, oh, I should have done this earlier. So whenever people are like, I don't know, I'm on the fence, should I do this, should I not? I'm always like, if you're more afraid of the unknown, I would say just do it. There's obviously things you have to consider with any sort of move or career switch, but like, if you're just afraid that you're not ready yet, I would just try it anyways, because a lot of times I'd move from LA after 4 or 5 years and I'd be like, why did I stay here for that long? You know? And it just happens with every single place. Why did I wait so long to have kids? Why did I wait so long to get married? Why did I wait so long to move? Why did I wait so long to start my own business? Everything I could have done like years before and just felt like, well, I'm not ready yet. And then you get in there and you're like, damn, I've been ready for this for years.
Was it fear to take the risk that held you back? I mean,
it's like fear to take the risk. Like, oh, I can't do this by myself. I need the people that I work with, even though they're dumbasses with two brain cells that they don't, you know, barely rub together. Or like, oh, I've got to work in this city because I can't do this anywhere else. I'm, you know, oh, I got to stay in this town. Oh, well, I can't afford to move to this part of town. Like all of that stuff has always been like, I should have done this before, or like, maybe I shouldn't commit. Oh no, now I'm married. You know, like it's just everything. I always tried to wait until I'm ready. And now I'm like, no, that's so overrated, man.
No, I agree 100%. So we're the same age. I want to ask you, Tupac or Biggie?
Ooh, tough one. I mean, lyrically Biggie, but cultural influence, Tupac.
I think Pac. I love Biggie, but Pac was gangster rap. That's what we grew up with. Told real stories. Biggie was more like club jams, and I wasn't into the club scene.
Got
but
it.
I grew up in Phoenix, so I was West Coast first. Then I
moved. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, Tupac, you know, he was less likable, which makes sense, because he was like a little bit of harder rap.
He likes the big guy. They're less threatened. They're always happy. That's how it always is.
He also seemed smarter to me, Biggie, but Tupac was a harder worker, probably. Hard to say. They were both like 27 when they died, right? Or less.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? No, they were like 25.
I know. Isn't that wild?
We were still in high school when that happened.
Do you remember thinking those are older guys like that are like 40?
Yeah.
And now I'm like, wait, they're like kids. They were literally like kids.
And they had the world by the balls.
Absolutely.
Do you remember White Boy Rick? You heard, remember the stories of that?
No, I mean, I do, but I don't. I remember the name.
Huge drug dealer, got hired by the FBI at 15 here in Detroit. And then the FBI hired him to sell drugs because he was selling guns in the street of Detroit. He was a white kid. And then all of a sudden he gets shot and he decides that, you know, the FBI turns their back on him, and then he heals, and then he starts selling drugs and becomes one of the largest drug lords in Detroit back in the 80s. And so I recently met him, and he's did the longest time for a nonviolent crime. It was 32 years than any human being ever in the United States.
Wow.
Nonviolent, 32 years. And so he went in at 17, he was making like 800 grand. But what made me think of that, we're talking about culture and things like that here in Detroit and how big he was. They made a movie about him that Matthew McConaughey was in recently as the dad. But that's another story. He was a kid. He went in at 17, never killed anybody, never hurt anybody, never, you know, anything in 32 years.
It's a long time. I mean, I guess if you sell drugs and guns, maybe you don't directly apply violence, but you indirectly apply violence. So I don't know how much.
I agree. I'm just saying that's he was a kid that got hired by the FBI to do it. I just thought that was odd how, you know, you think Tupac, Biggie at 25 get murdered. You see, you know, a kid like this, 17, it's The world we lived in back then didn't even have social media. Look at the impact now that social media has, where everybody wants something now. You talked about it earlier. I want to be successful now. I want to have money now. I want to drive a Lambo now. I want to own my business now. I want to sell this now. Whatever it is, I'm surprised that we haven't seen more of what we used to see with social media. Well, hey, listen, Jordan, I appreciate you sharing your story with us. How can people follow you and hear more of your episodes and get a hold of you?
Sure. The Jordan Harbinger Show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to podcasts. I put the occasional episode on YouTube, but mostly not, just because, again, going back to our conversation, the audience is better in podcasts than on YouTube. It's just higher quality. I'm also at Jordan Harbinger on Twitter and Instagram. People can add me on LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from your listeners, and I hope that we get some more folks listening and active on the Jordan Harbinger Show, because it's always good to have smart people checking out what we're doing. And thank you for the opportunity, man. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. I'm definitely going to try to reach out after this and pick your brain to blow this up. I've done really well in business, but, you know, taking this podcast out, I'm more of a motivational guy, you know, teaching people how to overcome adversity and open businesses and do well, yeah, and not take no for an answer. So definitely love to pick your brain on the podcast game. You've got it down. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. That's a wrap here on True Underdog. Make sure you visit us on iHeart, Google, Spotify, CastBox. Check us out at YouTube channel and trueunderdog.com. Bam!
And that concludes another episode here on True Underdog. If you're interested in hearing more, make sure you subscribe at iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the YouTube channel. You can always visit trueunderdog.com, subscribe to all of them. Make sure you check out our newest episodes coming out on Mondays and Thursdays. True Underdog, baby.
Bam! Damn, True Underdog. Damn.